So, you're a successful cartoonist and you want to tell the story of your life with bipolar disorder. What do you do? Ellen Forney started drawing.
It's a way to really explain the experience in a very vivid, kind of a visceral way.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about her very personal graphic memoirs. We'll also hear how to save the world with video games and spend an academic minute relying on your partner. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When I watched Ellen Forney's TED Talk, I was taken by the courage it took to talk about living with bipolar disorder in front of a crowd. It turns out she has a lot of experience in being open about her life. Ellen Forney is a cartoonist and mental health advocate who wrote the New York Times best-selling graphic memoir, Marbles, Mania, Depression, Michelangelo, and Me, the story of her diagnosis and struggle with bipolar disorder. She also wrote Rock Steady, Brilliant Advice for My Bipolar Life, A Guide to Maintaining Mental Health. I asked her why she felt her story was one she needed to tell.
I knew that it was a story I needed to tell for a number of different reasons. I mean, for one, I knew for me, I'm a storyteller. As a cartoonist, I'm a storyteller by trade. And in order to kind of work out how to think about certain difficult things in your life or the way that things roll out, especially something as complicated as bipolar disorder, looking back and trying to make sense of things. But the reason that I did it as a story for other people and not just for myself is a way to help others in the way that I had been helped, for example, by a couple of different memoirs. One was Kate Jameson's An Unquiet Mind about her bipolar, and William Styron wrote Darkness Visible about his suicidal depression. And I wanted to be able to add my voice, my story, in a way to give other people company. And because I work in comics using words and pictures and a lot more space on the page and a different way of expressing very internal things like emotions and moods, I felt like I had something to offer that hadn't really been offered before. So to help other people in a medium that I feel very passionately about as a storytelling medium.
Were you at all worried or concerned that it being a graphic memoir instead of just a regular old book, that it wouldn't be taken as seriously?
Well, I think, yes. I think it's an issue that I've grappled with for my whole career, really. I started as a professional cartoonist in 1992, and graphic novels and comics in general have gained in respect many, many times since the early 2000s, and then more and more all the time. I remember it was a big deal when the New York Times started reviewing comics. So I think that it's still kind of on its wave of credibility, kind of made its way into academia, and it's much more slowly but steadily making its way into the sciences, like medicine. There's a field called graphic medicine that this is definitely a part of, communicating stories by patients generally, but also by caregivers. And it's a very powerful way to tell these stories of health. Actually, I curated an exhibit for the National Library of Medicine about graphic medicine. It's really powerful and getting more and more recognized.
That was the one called Ill-Conceived and Well-Drawn?
Yes, indeed.
What was that? Talk about that just for a second. I read that you did that, but I couldn't really find what it was.
So that specifically was a traveling exhibit. So it's still traveling. It's in libraries and universities throughout the country. And and theoretically internationally, but I haven't looked at the list of places that recently, that explains what graphic medicine is, which is kind of the intersection of storytelling and comics and health and caregiving, and really explains how comics work, how words and pictures combine, and how powerful that is, and then also a whole bunch of examples of graphic memoirs and other kinds of comics about mental illness. My own comic, Marbles, Mania Depression, Michelangelo and Me, is featured in it. And then also comics about breast cancer and caregiving by a nurse, M.K. Serwick, about caring for AIDS patients in the 90s. And it's a way for people to recognize what the personal experience is like for a patient or for somebody who's going through it. And then also as a way for people dealing with certain health issues to communicate with caregivers. It's a way to really explain the experience in a very vivid, kind of a visceral way.
Well, telling your story by telling it in a book and drawing it is one thing, but getting up in front of people and talking about it, that's taken another step. How did that evolve? I talk for a living, and I couldn't do it in front of people doing something that personal.
Uh-huh. Well, I think just the same as anybody who does a book reading about a memoir, it's a thing to get in front of a whole lot of people and talk about something that's intimate. But if you've already put it out as a book, then we have to have some level of familiarity, some level of recognition that other people are privy to our stories. And so telling our stories openly in person is just, in some ways, just another variation on that. And I've taught for years, so getting up in front of a bunch of people and talking and doing my best to know what I'm talking about and keeping everything in order is something that I enjoy, really. I love giving talks. I really do. I love being able to talk with people in person and the kind of energy in a room that you can get. It's very different from a book. I mean, and a book has its own thing. There's a certain intimacy with a book. You hold it, and it's just you and this object. And the intimacy, I think, is that much more with a comic because it's hand-lettered and it's drawn, and you really get a sense of the author, of the cartoonist. So a book is a powerful experience in itself. So having a person, having that personal interaction with a talk and the audience and the book signing afterwards where I get to meet people one-on-one, it's a very different way of connecting with a story. I really enjoy both aspects of that.
You know, I never thought of it, but you're right. It's hand-lettered. That's an artwork all by itself. Most comics, you know, they give them to letterers who do that for a living.
Well, it varies from cartoonist to cartoonist. I would say a lot or most indie comics, so not the mainstream ones, not the kind of superhero ones, are hand-lettered, or sometimes a font that looks like hand-lettering. But one of the things about hand-lettering, it really is that intimacy and immediacy. I mean, think about getting a letter in the mail that's handwritten, or when somebody writes you a card and it's handwritten, there's some real reflection of their personality and who they are, and you know that they have touched that paper. And so reading a book that's hand-lettered really gets at the immediacy of the connection with the author.
When you do these talks, do you think you get as much out of it as the audience does?
Oh, I think it's very different what I get out of it and what the audience does. Well, I don't know what would that relationship be. I mean, not exactly a teacher and a student, but maybe something like that, in that I feel that I have something important that I want to share. I mean, I wouldn't be getting up there if I didn't feel like I had something important to share. And to see and really feel that people are processing that and getting something that they can incorporate personally into their own lives is all I can hope for, really. I mean, telling my own story isn't just about me. It's all about me. Because, I mean, that only has so much value, really, I think. That the hope is that my story has certain universal qualities. And whether that's to somebody who actually has bipolar and has maybe never seen anybody get up in front of a bunch of people and talk about it, or whether it's someone who is having a trouble having hope for overcoming something difficult, and maybe it's the hope and going through a journey and coming to the other side of it. But the idea that I might be able to help other, show other people, tell other people a story that they might find motivating or inspirational is really where that comes from. So I get a lot out of it, though it's something very different from the experience that I hope the audience gets.
Talk about the second book for a while. That was just released last year or the year before, Rocksteady. Mm-hmm. Is this a continuation of the story?
Well, it's the companion book. One of the things that was important to me in Marbles, which is my own personal story from my diagnosis through my 4 years of struggle to figure out how to be stable, I put in a number of pages on different coping tools, really. So like rather than saying I tried cognitive behavioral therapy and only one exercise was really helpful for me, I actually said that, but then put that exercise in to the book in a way that my readers could actually do it. I have some breathing exercises in there and some other things similarly informational. And a lot of people told me that it was really helpful and that they used Marbles, my memoir, as a manual. And I just know there's so much that didn't fit into Marbles along those lines. And there's so much more that I would have wanted to say about coping tools and the things that I've learned over the years. I mean, I've been stable now for 18 years and I've learned a lot. And I also love research. And so I put together basically a handbook for maintaining mental health. It's specifically geared towards addressing issues around bipolar and mood disorders, but a lot of it is applicable for everyone. I can rattle this off really quickly. My overall system, uh-huh. I have an acronym for it, of course, is SMEDMERTS. And there's a little mascot, this little kind of like toothy monster with basically doing jazz hands. And it's sleep. The absolute first thing for all of us is getting enough sleep, medications. That's for people who take medications, obviously, eating well and seeing your doctor or sticking with those things that help your health, mindfulness and meditation. Calming yourself down is so difficult and really it takes practice. And then we're up to E for exercise. Taking care of your body is so important. A routine, a good routine. Plenty of coping tools, that's T. And the last S is a solid support system because it's just too much to do for anyone on our own. So it's this wide variety of things that are all interconnected that are all essential, really, for us to take care of our mental health.
Well, finally, do you still consider yourself a crazy artist?
Well, you know, there's no cure for bipolar. So in that way, I say I'm crazy. I'm comfortable with the word crazy, although I do say it a bit tongue in cheek. So I would say, yeah, I'm a crazy artist, but like with the jazz hands.
The name of Ellen Forney's latest book is Rocksteady, Brilliant Advice for My Bipolar Life. We'll include a link to her TED Talk on the Best of Our Knowledge page at WAMC.org. Still to come, is it possible to save the world with video games? We'll explore that possibility next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. It could be a bit of hyperbole to say video games saved Jane McGonigal's life, but one that she developed did help her heal from a serious injury. That game is called Super Better, and that's also the name of her latest book. To understand how Jane McGonigal feels about video games, look no further than the title of her first book, Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. You can hear her talk about how games can make the world a better place on several TED Talks. I spoke to Jane McGonigal last fall and asked about her origin story in gaming and game design.
You know, I was lucky enough to be the first person in the world to try to study at a psychological and cognitive level how the video games that we play change how we respond to stress and challenge in everyday life. I got my PhD in that research area, and I have been studying games and making games to try to have a positive impact on people's real lives ever since.
And games are so easy to attack, and you hear it all the time by politicians and people in the media, but you say games make us the best version of ourselves. Tell us what you mean by that.
They can make us the best version of ourselves. There are some pitfalls, and we can talk about that you want to avoid. But the main thing that video games do, especially for young people, is they help us develop a challenge mindset, which means that we are confident in our ability to learn new skills, to develop new strategies, to get better at things that we are not good at the first time we try them. And this makes really intuitive sense. If you think about any game, it's designed for you to be bad at it the first time you try it, whether it's golf or chess or Fortnite. And playing a game is really about the pleasure of getting better, of mastering new skills and exploring different strategies. And it builds both the confidence in your own ability to get better through your own effort and attention, but it also builds the neurological pathways that allow your brain to respond to challenge and stress in a more positive way so that you're not dealing with anxiety. You are actually feeling energized by the opportunity to do something that's hard and to do something that allows you to get better.
And you say that most games will not give you a challenge that you are not skilled to master, right?
Well, that's just about right. Actually, what games do is they try to give you a challenge that is just fractionally beyond your current level, whether it's the first time you play a game, you are going to have a moment where you're confused or frustrated as you try to figure out that very first step. Or as you get better and you level up or you're playing against more difficult opponents, you're always being stretched to grow just a little bit. And it's why, you know, grown-ups don't play tic-tac-toe unless they're forced to by five-year-olds. Because once you stop learning and growing in a game, it gets boring and we don't play it anymore. Once you've sort of figured out every possible optimal move and there's nothing left to learn, you move on to a new game. And so video games are great in that either the levels can get more challenging, new content can get more difficult, or you just can find new players that are better than you and force you to continue to adapt and grow.
When you set out to develop a new game, how do you approach it? Story or skill?
That's really interesting. So the games that I create are usually designed to solve a specific problem for a player. So the game that I'm most famous for, Superbetter, I actually developed it to help me heal from a traumatic brain injury. I had a severe concussion that was not healing properly, and I was extremely depressed and anxious and had all the symptoms of vertigo and memory loss and nausea and migraines. And so I created a game around the goal of how can I get my brain to fire up all of those optimistic pathways, that motivated pathways that I used to have in normal life before the injury, so that I can kind of get back out of bed and reengage with daily life, even though it may be harder than it used to be. Can I bring that gameful mindset where I'm not just feeling anxious or depressed by the challenge, but actually feel like I can rise to the occasion? And so that game, you know, it started with essentially a neurological skill. What will force my brain to fire up those pathways, which tend to shut down when you have a traumatic brain injury or concussion, because your brain wants you to lie in bed and not hit itself again so that you stay healthy and recover. But that can lead to a lot of really dark mental health issues. So for me, when I design a game, I'm really thinking about what's the end result I want to have on the psychological health of the player or the cognitive skills of the player, and then using the research literature and also just my own intuition as a game designer to make sure that whatever we're doing is fun and interesting.
How important is the storyline then?
You know, the real story of any game is the story of the player's journey. So, you know, you take a game like Fortnite and the stories that players tell about it, it's not about the mythology of the universe. It's about what that player decided to do, the action that they took, the strategy they created, the collaboration that they entered into with their team members. So I think with games, the most important stories are the stories you can tell about yourself, stories about, you know, it was unbelievable pressure that I was under and I came up with this crazy idea and I tried it and it worked, or, you know, I was there for my team members, we were just about out of the match and I came in with this crazy move at the last minute, I was totally able to help and save the day. That story that we tell is really about ourselves, and it allows us to really reflect on our own positive strengths. And so I always encourage, you know, people when they think about gaming narrative, the story within the game is never going to be as important as the story that the player gets to tell about their own determination and creativity and teamwork.
You spoke about your game Super Better. There's now a book, Super Better, you just came out with, right?
Yeah, there is a book version, and it goes into all of the science behind how games can strengthen our real-life skills and abilities, whether it's in the sort of mental and cognitive area or social area or emotional area. And that was really a lot of fun to write because it gave me a chance to really dig deep and explain, you know, how could a game help people with such serious challenges like anxiety, depression, or traumatic brain injury? And it was really a great opportunity to say, wow, there are literally 500 peer-reviewed scientific papers that can help us understand exactly what's happening in our brains and in our relationships when we play games together.
What are alternative reality games?
So there's a genre of game that is really intentionally designed to bring games off of our screens and out into real spaces. Some of the games that I worked on years ago when I was first designing games, they were the first games to be using GPS so that we would know where in the world you were, so that we could give you something to do in the real world based on whether you were near a payphone that you could answer and solve a puzzle, or you could go to a park and meet up with other players and do a creative challenge. And if you think about Pokemon Go, that's really the best example of where that genre of games has evolved, where now you can go out into the real world and move around in real spaces and have this wonderful face-to-face social interaction with your real-life friends and family and with other people in your community. But we're really trying to make sure that games are firmly embedded in our everyday lives and everyday spaces so that it's not just about escaping, but it's really about engaging with the real world in more fun and positive ways.
When you see something like Pokemon Go, do you sit back and say, geez, I wish I'd thought of that?
Oh, you know, it's amazing. When Pokemon Go, the phenomenon, first happened, I was just celebrating because my first book, Reality is Broken, which I published, I think, 5 years before Pokemon Go came out, I was talking about what the future of games could be, you know, what we could all experience if we brought games out into the real world and more embedded in our real relationships and real lives. And so to have made that kind of a future forecast and to see it play out was really fulfilling for me personally. And I still play it every day with my daughters. I have twin daughters. And so we are living the future, and I'm really happy about that.
So one of your goals, and do you see this happening, are we solving real-world problems with games?
Yeah, I mean, my biggest goal right now is I'm developing a series of future forecasting games that allow people to better anticipate the long-term consequences of new technologies. So, you know, what if Facebook had been able to foresee fake news 10 years ago? What if Twitter had been able to foresee the kinds of social media bullying that has become common? What if Apple had been able to foresee the kind of smartphone addiction that so many people feel, and that we're feeling like the technology is hurting our mental health instead of improving it. So I'm working with the Institute for the Future to develop these future forecasting games so that we have a chance to think about things like self-driving cars and augmented reality and virtual reality and automation of jobs and really kind of get ahead of where these technologies might take us so that we can predict what might go wrong and brainstorm solutions and strategies before we wake up in a future that we don't want to actually be living in.
Jane McGonigal is a video game designer, author, and public speaker. We'll also include a link to several of her TED Talks on the Best of Our Knowledge page at WAMC.org. One of the most effective weapons in battling low self-esteem or depression is a good partner. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Need help during a time of low self-esteem? Rely on your partner. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Matthew Johnson, assistant professor in the Department of Agricultural, Life, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Alberta, looks into where to find support during a rough period.
There's been much recent interest in understanding how self-esteem and depression are intertwined over time, with most studies showing poor self-esteem is a precursor to future feelings of depression. Our study examined how couple relations might be implicated in the self-esteem to depression pathway. We found receiving support from a partner during times of stress led to reduced feelings of depression 1 year later and higher self-esteem for women. Men received an added benefit when they provided support to their partner. Their own self-esteem increased. Experiencing stress leaves us vulnerable, particularly when the stress is especially severe and prolonged, which may be why a partner listening and offering concrete forms of assistance has such notable and long-lasting impact. Our study also examined how self-esteem and symptoms of depression influence future support. Partners with better mental health, those with higher self-esteem among women and less depression for men, tended to receive more support in the future. Those who have a better self-concept and fewer feelings of hopelessness likely possess the capacity to reach out and ask a partner for help when needed. But those partners are also probably better able to manage the stress on their own. Those who would benefit most from their partner's support are those with poorer mental health to start with, but poor mental health was linked with less support in the future. Why might that be? It may be hard to know exactly how to support a partner suffering from mental health issues. Someone with low self-esteem or who is feeling depressed may push those close to them away or withdraw when faced with stressors. But our research shows stepping up and offering support in those circumstances, hard as it may be, can yield dividends long into the future.
That was Matthew Johnson of the University of Alberta. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.
Thank you.